Good. The tape is rolling. Charles, can you take me back to how you found out about Kurt Cobain's death?
I was the editor of a magazine called The Rocket, which was a biweekly music and entertainment magazine in the Northwest that had begun in 1979 and was the first magazine to ever really cover Nirvana, the first magazine to put them on the cover. And so we were kind of ground central for Northwest music scene. And I was sitting in my office on April 8th, 1994, and got a phone call from someone at a local radio station. And the words out of his mouth were, "Do you think it's possible Kurt Cobain is dead?" And that radio station had just gotten a call from, bizarrely, an electrical contractor who'd been installing some stuff in Kurt's house. And the police had just then been called. And the station was calling me to see if I potentially could confirm it or if I knew anything.
And you hadn't known anything at that point.
Of course, no one knew anything. Everyone knew Kurt was struggling with drugs. And, you know, I mean, that was no secret in Seattle and or anywhere in the world at that point. And he obviously had had Rome just a month before, which, even though it was reported as a drug overdose, there were already rumors and talk that it was a suicide attempt. So the words out of my mouth to the radio station were, no, it couldn't possibly be Kurt. And I think that was just denial to some degree. But it was a slight truth, I guess, in that I knew some of Kurt's friends, and many of them, frankly, were worse off than Kurt in terms of their drug problems. And I just thought it had to be one of his buddies. It just simply couldn't be him. But it certainly was him. And, you know, we think he died on April 5th.
Seattle engineer here.
Yeah.
Can we take a moment to adjust the mic? We're
sure.
Just on the verge of popping.
Okay. Just tell me where you want me to. You want to move it closer?
It's just catching some air, and I just want to move it a little bit out of that range. Just a second.
The irony is, Wisconsin, you guys wouldn't know it, and I don't even know that Doug knows it. Maybe he's heard me talk about it before, but the building we're in, where KUOW is in, there was a club in the basement of this building that Nirvana played in. So, you know, the irony to some degree is in Seattle, even today in 2014, 20 years after Kurt died, there virtually on every block of the city, I could tell you some story related to Nirvana or to Kurt or to Seattle music. But this building, the basement of it, sported the Sub Pop 100 record release party, which included Nirvana and a bunch of other bands.
Wow. Huh. Interesting. Well, we should pick up the story where we left off. Let me just jump in here. Of course, it turned out that Kurt Cobain didn't die of a drug overdose. He died from a shotgun. What was your reaction when you found out?
Well, obviously, his suicide was incredibly shocking. And his choice of death to shoot himself with a shotgun was unbelievably horrific. You know, in researching his life later as his biographer, you know, what I found out was that that was one of probably a dozen suicide attempts. And if you actually look at his drug addiction and how many times he overdosed on drugs, those, to some degree, you can also call sort of a suicide attempt, or at least a choice to put yourself in a reckless disregard for living. This was part of a pattern, but, you know, his death was just so horrible. It truly is one of the most horrible days of my life. It certainly is the most horrible day of Seattle music ever. And for anybody that was a Nirvana fan, it was unbelievably heartbreaking. And whether you were a fan of Nirvana or not, a celebrity of that stature choosing to take his own life at the height of his fame was enough to make you take notice. And I do think that plays some role in Kurt's enduring legacy, and it is one of the reasons we're still talking about him 20 years after his death. But it's certainly not the only one. I think that you know, his suicide, however horrible, was only a small part of his legacy, if it's what many people remember.
Well, we should talk about his legacy. I mean, it's been 20 years now since he died, and you have a book out on the 20th anniversary of his death, and the subtitle of your book is The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. What do you see as his legacy? Why does he still matter?
Well, in the book, I outline, you know, five or six different areas where you can kind of measure his impact. But by far and away, music is the way his impact has had the biggest shadow. Nirvana this year, nominated in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on the first year of their eligibility, nominated, strangely, in some ways, for a single, and it was a single of a song that Kurt didn't even write. But that shows you, to some degree, how sure the band's legacy has been within the annals of rock history.
What was the single? So,
the single was Love Buzz, and with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you qualify 25 years after your first released recording. So rather than Nirvana's first album, which was Bleach, which would be another year or so away, they decided to, you know, let the band qualify based on that single. And it might not be the first band that ever got into the Hall of Fame based on a single, but I can definitively say it is the first band in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame based on a single that was a cover song and that only 1,000 copies were made of when it was initially pressed. That, in some ways, kind of shows you the shift in Nirvana. Love Buzz first came out, 1,000 copies were pressed, and if you happen to have one of those initial 1,000 copies, which are numbered, you would own something that's worth maybe $10,000
now.
But they're absolutely the first band ever to get in the Hall of Fame on a single that only 1,000 copies were made of.
Yeah.
So that shows you to some degree that the work they did after that single had such an incredible impact on music and on so many other bands that would follow.
And especially
that's why they were in the Hall of Fame.
Especially on alternative music. I mean, Nirvana and Kurt Cobain, I mean, they really shifted the way alternative music was performed, right?
Well, I would go beyond that, and I would say they had a major impact on shifting all of music. In some ways, they made the genre of alternative even happen. But I think their impact was almost larger. Alternative rock, there were Sonic Youth and there were a number of other alternative rock bands that had had some level of success before Nirvana. But what happened is that mainstream music changed. The music that was on top 40 radio changed after Nirvana, not just the music that was on college radio stations or on alternative stations. In some ways, Nirvana's music, which let's just take Smells Like Teen Spirit and say, you know, it's an aggressive sounding song. They made pop music become more aggressive.
Because it really had been kind of soft rock before that, right? I mean, that is what ruled the airwaves.
Yeah, I mean, I think people forget that in the era right before Nirvana, the biggest songs of that decade were all what we call hair metal rock ballads. It was Bon Jovi and Warrant and, you know, even Guns N' Roses, but Guns N' Roses broke with Patience. They broke with their ballads. You know, it was the kind of thing that music just really was awful, frankly. At least top 40 music was awful in the era before Nirvana. And Smells Like Teen Spirit comes on, and suddenly this single is now on top 40 radio and on MTV, and everywhere you turned, that single was. And from that point forward, I think the idea of what even could be a hit song shifted to some degree.
Well, and it also seems like, I mean, one of the distinguishing features of, especially when Nirvana came out, I mean, when Nevermind came out, it was not only incredibly popular, it was hugely popular among the critics. I mean, it had all this critical acclaim.
Well, that's interesting to say, because in this book I do chart that, and that's not necessarily a statement I think that's completely true. It eventually had that critical acclaim. But initially, the album, Nevermind, It's Fascinating to Look At, was not necessarily a huge hit with critics. It had generally positive reviews, but they were not raves for the most part. I'm proud to say at the Rocket, we did rave about the album, but not everybody did. Rolling Stone gave Nevermind 3 stars, 3 out of 5 stars upon its release. And in one of the craziest pieces in rock history, on the magazine's website, the album now has 4 stars. They've given it an extra star, you know, over the years.
A little revisionist thinking here.
Exactly. And what's even more interesting to note is that Nevermind, a record that Rolling Stone gave 3 stars, and that in 1991, both Rolling Stone and Spin, at the end of the year, named Nevermind the 3rd best record of the year behind 2 others. But both those magazines, by the end of the 90s, named Nevermind, the 3rd best album of 1991, the best album of the decade, of the entire decade. And not only that, Rolling Stone, in a relatively recent poll, named Nevermind the 17th best album of all time. So you do see some revisionist history. The impact of the record has certainly grown. The critical reputation of Nevermind, of Nirvana, and of Kurt Cobain has shifted dramatically over the years, and that's something that I wanted to chart in this book.
So explain that for me. I mean, why was this such a great album, Nevermind?
Well, I argue it's a great album to some degree because it is. You know, we can kind of look at the critical reputation, and there is a point where for a record to have both that level of commercial success and over time be ranked so high in critics' polls, maybe there actually is some truth. I quote Occam's razor in the book and says that sometimes the simplest answer to any problem is the answer that's right before you. And, you know, to me personally as a listener, the reason that it's a great record is that the songwriting is just incredible. You know, listen to Smells Like Teen Spirit, read the lyrics, and you'll be blown away by Kurt's artistry. But I also think sonically that you listen to Smells Like Teen Spirit, and before Kurt even sings, it's a great song. That drum beat that Dave Grohl pounds out starting that song is just unstoppable. Kurt wrote very, very catchy songs, but he also had a great band. He had a great producer, and you know, everything came together on that record. Every single piece of that album, from the album cover to the name of the band to the name of the album, it all just was absolutely perfect and perfectly timed. And rarely do you see that combination of talent, marketing, and just plain luck. If Nevermind would have come out today, I still think it would be a big, big album. But no record that comes out today sells 35 million copies.
35 million copies. That's how many copies Nevermind.
No one exactly knows, because reporting on an album when it gets that big becomes gigantic. I can't remember if I left this in the book or not, but I think I took it out. You know, sometimes you write things in your book and you don't, you know, they don't end up in the final version. But Courtney Love once called me to ask me how many copies Nevermind sold, because she was looking at a royalty statement and wanted to see if it was actually, you know, accurate. I mean, when the numbers get that big, it becomes hard to figure out. And record companies often don't want to report exactly what a record has sold. And it's hard to figure out in every foreign country. But at a minimum, it sold 25 million. So, I mean, compare that, as I mentioned in the book, to the top-selling rock record of 2012, which was Mumford & Sons, which sold 3.5 million. That's not in the same ballpark as 35 million.
Right. Now, the other thing that comes through in Kurt Cobain's songs, so many of his songs, is his voice, his pain, for one thing. I mean, you know, authenticity is an overused word, but it's there. You can't deny it.
It is there. And I think the word you're focusing on is what I really think is the key to why Kurt was a great artist. And the word is voice, but I don't necessarily mean that just to talk about his vocals. I mean the tone, the attitude, the focal point of the songs. All of that is his voice. In some ways, it's his narration. when you listen to a Nirvana song, you think Kurt is narrating the song to you. And many times these songs are about his life. Most of his great songs are about his life. So he becomes the narrator, just like Melville starts, you know, Moby Dick with Call Me Ishmael. He immediately establishes a voice. And to some degree, when Kurt comes back with In Utero and begins the first song of his follow-up record to Nevermind and says, "Teenage angst has paid off well, now I'm bored and old," this is a narration of that sort. And all of his great songs kind of have him as narrator. And that's one reason I think that his work stands above many others. As a songwriter, he focused on his voice. That's one reason that Bleach, I don't think, is half the record that Nevermind was, is that Kurt hadn't quite figured it out yet. He was still writing songs about lots of weird things, and they weren't about him. And I kind of cite that to 1990 when Nirvana put a song out called Sliver, where the chorus is, "Grandma, take me home, Grandma, take me home." That song is really, I think, the first time that Kurt figured out his voice, that his best material was going to ultimately be about him. And from that point forward, he could do no wrong.
Now, you were there, as you've said, running this music magazine. You know, you were sort of charting the rise of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. Were you eagerly anticipating the release of Nevermind? I mean, did you know this was going to be big?
Well, it's funny to look in retrospect. No one knew it was going to be this big. I thought it was going to be big, but the standard was 100,000 copies. You know, I was at the record release party for Nevermind, which was held in a small club in Seattle. And, you know, I predicted at that the record would sell 100,000 copies. I wasn't the only one predicting that. The guys from Sub Pop were there predicting it as well. But that was kind of the glass ceiling of alternative rock. Sonic Youth had sold 100,000 copies. But no one actually thought it would sell that much. I was kind of the boosterist hometown rock critic hoping that. But it's important to note that Geffen Records, Nirvana's label, or DGC, the division of Geffen, they only printed 42,000 copies of Nevermind when it first came out. So clearly they didn't think it was going to sell 100,000, at least initially, because there is an economy of scale when you're printing up albums where it would be far cheaper. If they thought it was going to sell 35 million, they could have made 35 million the day it came out and made it at a third the price or far less than that, and made more profits. No one knew it was going to do what it did. And that includes Kurt himself. You know, he wanted to be successful, but the success that the record ultimately had surprised everyone. And if you meet any critic or anyone who says that they knew that Nirvana were going to sell that much and be that big, they're lying.
Was it obvious that Smells Like Teen Spirit was going to be the big hit on that album?
No. In fact, it was not obvious, and it wasn't even planned to be the big hit. Even the label, like when you have an alternative rock record in that era, the plan was that you release a record a single that kind of gets college radio, your typical market, to embrace it. And then you release a second single, which is your big commercial single. And with Nevermind, what was planned is, you know, Come As You Are was planned as you know, that was going to be the song that was going to really push Nirvana over. Smells Like Teen Spirit was kind of almost the lost leader. It was thrown out there, and I don't think anyone at the label or anyone involved in Nirvana thought it would be as big a single as it was. The concept at that point was that that song was way too aggressive, loud, and if you want to use the term, nasty almost, to ever make it to top 40 or to ever be played on MTV. The concept with that video was that it would appear on MTV's specialty show, which was called 120 Minutes, and that's where it debuted. But the idea that it would be on mainstream 3 in the afternoon MTV was beyond anyone's expectations or even imagination.
So how do you explain the success of this particular song then?
It couldn't be stopped. It was like a runaway train. I mean, you heard the song and you wanted to hear it more. You know, for Heavier Than Heaven, I interviewed, you know, Marco Collins, who also is quoted in this book, talking about the song's success and impact. But at our local, you know, kind of commercial alternative station, which was called The End, which played a big role in breaking Smells Like Teen Spirit, they initially only played the song at night. But, you know, people heard it and said, I want to hear it. So they got so many requests, they were forced to then play it during the day. The idea was at night, the standards were lower. You could play something wild and rocking. And in the day when, you know, grandma's driving to the grocery store, you know, you might not play something quite so aggressive. Smells Like Teen Spirit changed the entire template for what a hit pop song could be, even on alternative rock. So it wasn't the song that everyone thought was going to be the single. But you listen to that song, and it's hard to imagine that it's a hit. It's a hit. It has that undefinable, you know, essence of hitdom. The voice, the melodies, the contrast, everything about that song is a hit. But prior to 1991, there were never hits like that on the radio.
Well, and partly what's fascinating about this story is, to some degree, it defied the tastemakers of radio, for instance. I mean, there's obviously this popular groundswell. I mean, people just wanted to hear that song. And then, you know, as they demanded it, then it got played. And then, you know, it took off.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I think Nevermind and to some degree Kurt Cobain couldn't happen today. You know, I write in the new book, I say, you know, could someone with a fragile ego like Kurt Cobain survive the concept of Facebook, where he puts up a, you know, SoundCloud, you know, file of Smells Like Teen Spirit and gets 50 likes and, you know, most of his friends don't even respond because there's so much other stuff that's being thrown up at them. Nevermind came at the perfect time for that album because it came at a time when there wasn't the dissemination of music. People had to find music. You had to go drive to the record store and buy an album. It meant something. It wasn't you just hit a button on the computer and immediately downloaded it. It took a while for the album to spread. I mean, I think people forget at times that by the time that Nevermind broke, Nirvana had already conducted 8 different tours at that point. They had put in their 10,000 hours, if you want to take Malcolm Gladwell's theory. They had played in crappy clubs from Europe to Albuquerque and had really done their time. They were a finely honed unit at that point. But if success had come to them instantly, and even if Nevermind had blown up the way an album might now, I think it might have destroyed Kurt earlier on, and the band wouldn't have had the life that they did.
Now, as we've been saying, I mean, this album, Nevermind, was this huge monster hit, and you know, it's considered one of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time, or rock albums, I should say. But you don't actually think this is Nirvana's best album, right?
I don't. That's the funny part, to some degree. I don't, Kurt didn't, and most rock critics don't. In Utero, the record which is the follow-up to Nevermind, I think is an artistic achievement that even puts Nevermind to shame. Because I think as a songwriter, Kurt was just simply getting better and better and better. Certainly In Utero does not have the pop sheen that Nevermind did. It's produced by Steve Albini, who was a much rawer producer, and Nirvana wanted to go back to a kind of raw punk sound. To some degree, they didn't want another record to sell 35 million. And instead, they got a record that when it came out sold something like 3.5 million, which was ultimately then somewhat disappointing. They wanted it both ways. They wanted it to be popular, but they didn't want to look like they were trying to be popular. And but I think In Utero is a greater artistic achievement. And that's not to take anything away from Nevermind, which I love. And I frankly probably play more than I play In Utero. But, you know, I think In Utero, Kurt as a songwriter is just firing on all cylinders and getting better and better and better, which ultimately makes his death only a few months after In Utero's release seem even sadder and even a greater tragedy.
Do you have a favorite song on In Utero?
Well, I love Serve the Servants, but Heart-Shaped Box is probably my favorite song. You know, though the history of that song, when you go back and look at it and look at the fact that, it was initially titled Heart-Shaped Coffin, and that it was a messy song, but all of Kurt's lyrics were pretty messy psychologically. I can't tell you, as his biographer, when I began to look through his journals and to see things like alternative lyrics or a different title to a song, how shocked I was. Because as a fan, much of this material I didn't know. I didn't know it was quite that dark. But in some ways, it actually makes the artistic achievement of what he did accomplish seem even greater to me, because he had so much more that he had to overcome.
Now, it would seem, in retrospect, certainly, that Kurt Cobain had a hard time handling success. I mean, he was suddenly huge. He was, you know, monstrously popular. And then his life's just spiraled downhill.
Well, he did have a hard time handling success, but at the same point, he had a hard time handling life when he wasn't successful. He just simply had a hard time handling life. You know, that's an argument that often gets bantied around. Did fame cause Kurt's death? If MTV hadn't played his song so much, and if he hadn't become so popular, would he be alive today? And I think that the truth is that Kurt struggled way before he ever became famous, and that many of the things that were present in his life, depression, physical pain, a tendency towards addiction, a very difficult family upbringing, all of those things were true before he ever picked up a guitar and before he ever was on MTV. And if fame were the only problem in his life, he certainly could have retreated from the fame and quit. You know, that is possible. But I think there was a whole number of different psychological things at play that sort of led to ultimately his decision to take his own life.
Of course, we can never know why someone chooses to commit suicide, but what's your best guess as to why he chose to kill himself?
Well, I think it traces to the physical pain that he had dealt with during much of his life. That, more than anything, I think, leads to hopelessness among people when someone has chronic pain that they don't feel like that they can get an answer to.
What was the chronic pain he was dealing with?
He had chronic stomach pain that had haunted him for most of his adult life. And he also had chronic back pain, and he certainly had chronic depression and chronic psychological pain. You add all of that mix together, and then you put the issues that are complicated by his addiction into there, and you get a very toxic mix.
His addiction to heroin in particular?
Exactly. But one thing that I think that it is interesting to note, that there were a number of people that I interviewed for Heavier Than Heaven who were friends of Kurt, who grew up with him in that world, and several of them are dead from either suicide or drug addiction now. And these are people that never had an album out and never were on the cover of Rolling Stone. These problems are not just about his fame or about his career choice. They are a result of a whole complicated series of things. Some of it, frankly, is being from a socioeconomic world that Kurt was from in Aberdeen that gave people less choices and made suicide an option that was more talked about. And the suicide rates are certainly higher in some of those communities.
Now, there was a public memorial after Kurt Cobain's death at Seattle Center, which turned into a huge event. You say it was one of the most extraordinary events you have ever witnessed. Can you?
I've never been to anything like it, and I doubt I will ever be. Remember, this is pre-internet, which makes everything about Nirvana become fascinating. But with 2 days' notice, Kurt is found on Friday. This memorial comes together on Sunday. Now, imagine in the era before you have, an email to easily, you know, pass around to somebody, how you can even mobilize people or tell them about something. But on 2 days' notice, 10,000 people gathered at Seattle Center for this public memorial, and nobody really knew what was going to happen or how it was going to come together. I ran into one of the organizers, Marco Collins, right before the event, and I said, "What's going to happen?" He said, "I don't know." And what ultimately happened was that a few people spoke, a few DJs spoke, a short recording from Chris Novoselic was played, and then absolutely the most extraordinary thing that I've ever heard in my life, Courtney Love played a tape or a tape was played that she made the night before, where she both talked about Kurt and some of her anger for him, asked the entire crowd to curse Kurt together, and they did, which truly was a great moment because it gave people the ability that it's okay to have anger about the choices that he made. There's a whole myriad of emotions that you feel when you're dealing with a suicide.
So she had recorded this beforehand. They were playing the recording, and then she came to the memorial.
Then she showed up,
right?
And the recording included her reading Kurt's suicide note, and then she shows up at the actual event with the suicide note in her hand. You just couldn't make this stuff up. And one of the great ironies that I talk about in this book is that, there's been this fallacy that Kurt's suicide caused a number of other copycat suicides. And what the suicide experts that studied it actually found was the opposite, that in the era, the year after Kurt's death, suicides in King County, where Kurt died, actually went down. Not hugely, but slightly. But it's the opposite of what has always been thought. There were, frankly, if there were copycat suicides, there were very few. And that Kurt's death and highly publicized death ultimately kind of played, I don't know if what you want to call it, a cautionary effect on people to realize how horrible it was. And one of the ironies of Courtney showing up at this event and the tape that she did and the anger expressed and the suicide note and how she talked about it, a suicide expert told me it ultimately ended up as great public health service because
with the irony of
craziness,
Courtney Love is the
insanity. Exactly. But in her complete, total insanity of the moment, the fact that she could talk about the anger she had and lead the crowd in that chant, and the fact that she was very explicit in talking about what Kurt did, took away the glamour. When Marilyn Monroe died, there were copycat suicides because that suicide by pills and, in love with President Kennedy or whatever the heck she was, that glamorized that death. It made it romantic. Kurt's death, frankly, by shotgun, horrible. The fact that all of that was publicized and everyone knew that effect and the real story made his death ultimately something that probably actually saved some lives in that next year rather than cost lives. And I'm not saying that's a significant effect, but I'm saying that it wasn't what everyone expected and what has widely been reported for the last 20 years, that Kurt died and other people followed him and did copycat suicides. The actual science shows that that was not the case in King County.
You describe Kurt Cobain as the last true rock star. What makes you think that?
Well, I hope there are other rock stars. I hope he's not the last. But to this point in time, on that rock and roll timeline, which maybe begins with Elvis and includes the Beatles and Bob Dylan and John Lennon and U2 and Bruce Springsteen and REM, perhaps, it depends on, who you truly like. There hasn't been anybody that quite has had that singular focus in their songwriting. There have been other great rock stars. There have been other rock stars. But there hasn't been rock star, capital rock, and also a star that it isn't just about the commercial success. It's about their artistic statement. I think ultimately that's one reason we're still talking about Kurt, is that that songwriting skill that he brought to everything he did, that voice, as I mentioned earlier, and not just his vocals, the sheer Kurtness that was in every song he wrote, that charisma, that undefinable star quality, we haven't seen that in one person in rock in the last 20 years. There have been people who've come close. There have been great albums. There have been great musicians. But there hasn't been somebody that quite has had that. And as a fan of music, I sure hope we get that soon because we need it. When these characters come along that have the capacity to make music that is so passionate, that is so pure in some ways, where so much of themselves is there in the music and in the lyrics, as a listener, you feel it and it changes you. And Kurt's it in my line, in my rock and roll line. And I need and I want someone else. So young guys working in basements and young girls working in garages, get to it, because we need a great voice in music.
Now, one of the surprises I had when I was reading your book is I hadn't realized how influential Kurt Cobain has been on the hip-hop world. I mean, he's just quoted all the time, actually.
I hadn't realized it either, you know, frankly, before I began researching the book. And I had, you know, I'm not a someone who's an expert in hip hop, even though I will say Seattle has, you know, generated Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, the single biggest stars in rap and hip hop of the last couple years. But absolutely, Kurt has had a huge impact in hip hop. He has been sampled significantly. He has become a figure in lyrics of a number of hip hop songs. And even though the music that he did has very little, at least on paper, to do with hip hop, he's become influential. And that is a bizarre outcome that I maybe never would have predicted. I mean, the ultimate, you know, sort of symbol of that is the song that came out from Jay-Z just this last year called Holy Grail, which not only name checks Kurt, but it also samples Smells Like Teen Spirit. And then here in the weirdest thing that maybe ever has happened in Nirvana's career, at the Grammy Awards this year, Kurt Cobain was nominated in the best rap song category because, or included in it, you know, he was one of a number of nominations because the lyrics to Smells Like Teen Spirit were part of that song's composition. He lost, I think, to Macklemore, if I'm remembering correctly, another Seattle artist, but he was nominated in that category, which is truly bizarre.
One final question. If there is one other Kurt Cobain song we haven't talked about yet that that we should talk about, something to go out on, what would be that song?
Well, one of my favorite songs is a song that kind of predates some of the things I'm talking about, where, you know, he really became so singular. But it's one of his great pop moments, and that is About a Girl from Nirvana's first album, Bleach. That's one of the purest pop moments in his entire catalog. He told one of his friends, as I quote in Heavier Than Heaven, that he had listened to Meet the Beatles all day before he sat down and wrote that song. And the song is ostensibly about his girlfriend, but it really is one of the purest pop moments that he ever did. And I love that song, and I listen to it endlessly.
Okay, that was great. Thank you.
You're welcome.